Patrick Chilton, Reel 3.
Well, you were asking about the British hospitals. I had one terrible experience myself personally, because I was lunching with a friend of mine up the top of the Khyber Pass. He was staff captain. And like in those days, lunch used to go on rather late with friends on the lawn at about 4:30. And she wanted to go and see the Hindu Kush, which you could see very well. It's a beautiful range of mountains from Nandikotal. Well, I had to get back. So I said to her sister, who was married to the chief of the RAF intelligence, and she said, "Oh, I'll drive you back in my big American car." And so off we set. And I don't remember any of this at all. But she was driving, and I remember wanting to drive, but she said no, she would want to drive. And we apparently hit a bridge and went down 17 foot into a nullah, which is a dry riverbed. It was dry at the time. And apparently it was 6 hours before we were found by a shepherd who was driving along his sheep along the thing. Well, anyhow, he took my girl watch and my posh teen, but he went to his Malaya college and called for help, and they sent out ambulances. And of course she was dead by this time, and I was bleeding heavily. I mean, I split my skull, I had bad hand injuries and everything else about me. But they took me to Peshawar Hospital. And I think I was unconscious for 10 days at least. But anyhow, I came round and I had marvellous medical attention. Absolutely wonderful. But that was a very good hospital. And of course, they had one in every station. Of course, every regiment has their own medical officer to look after the troops. I mean, every one has a RAMC officer.
Were there any special precautions you had to take?
Not in that part of the world. You know, malaria is a sort of common thing. We didn't have it actually out there. No, we didn't. We had to have the TAB injection. That was always a thing, whereby all the troops had to be done regularly. Now, to do that, it was always done by, of course, the medical officer. But you always had to have a British officer, executive officer, on parade when the troops were done. This was the law. And of course, once I was chosen, the one thing I can't stand is seeing anybody being injected. And of course, I got whiter and whiter as the men pulled up their sleeves, and I started to faint. I was dragged out unceremoniously out of the room, and that's the last time I ever was asked to appear on a medical inspection.
Were there many cases of heat exhaustion or sunstroke?
We had one, yes. There was an awfully nice sergeant I had called Crosby. Of course, he was nicknamed Bing. He was a charmer, and I think it was mainly due to constipation, which was a thing that every troop had to avoid out there. That was the greatest thing which brought on heat stroke. But if he was working normally, there was really no danger. And of course, we all wore these wretched topies. In fact, it was a court-martial offence to go outside your bungalow without wearing a topi. Of course, that myth disappeared in the war, but that was the rule in those days. But sunstroke rarely doesn't occur by the heat on the back of the neck. We know that now. But in those days, that was what they thought. But he died. But I don't remember any other bad case of heat stroke.
Was venereal disease a problem?
Well, not really, because we did have cases, and the punishments were really quite severe, because the man had to make up all the parades that he'd missed in hospital, which was really quite severe, because in those days there was no penicillin or these sort of things they cure it with today. It only took about 3 weeks to cure a man. But we did try and prevent it by having our own brothels, which if he contacted there, he was freed, because the medical officer inspected the girls. We used to call them Nautch girls. I don't know why Nautch, but I can't remember. I remember the Nautch girls were always put in the brothels. And they were then told to use the brothel, but if they didn't, and they went out elsewhere, well, they'd had it. And that was the end of that, because it could be quite severe. Particularly in those days, we didn't have any quick cure. It was jolly painful, I believe.
Did the shortage of women lead to any cases of homosexuality?
Well, not that I know of, because don't forget, we were terribly segregated from the troops. I don't remember any court-martial or anything like that. In England, yes, I do remember, but not out there. And the band boys, of course, were very segregated. under the bandmaster. I mean, there was none of that. I don't know whether that was so, but I doubt it. I don't think so. Might have been the rare case, possibly.
How much information were you given about the Indian political scene?
None at all. That was an extraordinary thing. We were there, I suppose, to keep the peace in India. That was the object. But we never had any political lectures or anything. All we knew about was the Indian Congress, which was supposed to be terrible. You know, we almost lived in horror of them. People like Gandhi, you know, Nehru, and all the people we put in prison. That's the only thing we ever knew about. No, we weren't. We were terribly ignorant about the Indian political scene. It was terrible, really, but looking back. But, of course, we were told to do our job and not to reason why. And that was the soldiers. Well, we were just given orders.
Was there much discussion of it at all in the fort? No, not at all.
It was mostly hunting and a bit of partridge shooting occasionally and things like that. Womanizing, you know. Of course, we were never allowed to mention a woman's name in the mess. But, we never mentioned politics at all. We didn't know anything about it. Stop.
Do you think independence came as a surprise to
you? Well, I suppose so. But, of course, by that time, we'd been out of India a long time. I mean, you see, at the beginning of the war, we were moved to Malta. And independence didn't come until about 1947. 48, so that was some time after.
But while you were there, you didn't envisage the role of the British Army as suddenly ending?
No, I don't think so. I think that the British Raj was all set. The sun was never going to set, as far as we were concerned, and we loved it out there. Of course, I suppose, thinking back, now I'm older and wiser, I knew it was going to come, obviously, but we never thought about it.
Arrangements were made for leave?
Oh, leave was terribly good. Very, very good. On the frontier, I don't know if this applies to the rest of India, but on the frontier we were given 4 months every year. And after 3 years' service, you were given 7 months. Well, the reason for that is, of course, you had to get home. Now, travel wasn't like it was today. The best way home, if you could afford it, was to go by a thing called Imperial Airways, which is the most hazardous trip. Because they only flew by day and had to have fairly cloudless skies because navigation was very tricky, but they were flying boats. And you used to go, it took 5 days to get to London from Karachi, I used to fly regularly. And then you spend all your money, and the result was you had to come back P&O third class steerage for 3 weeks on the way back. So you see, you needed quite a long time to get back to England, see your relations and friends and so on. So that's why they gave you 7 months, which sounds an awful lot today, but this was necessary, because it took you 3 weeks and another 5 days travelling alone. But on the frontier, they were very good, and there were marvellous places to go to. The P&O ran an awfully good trip to Bali. What they did was they used to give officers very reduced fares on their way to Australia, because a lot of passengers got off at Karachi, and they had to go on to Australia. But they wanted to fill the boat up, and so they offered us terrific reductions of fares if we'd go on the trip, and they'd pick us up on the way back. So you could go to Bali or Australia very cheaply. I think the fare was £30 return or something. It was something stupid. And then, of course, there was the marvellous Kashmir holidays, skiing and these houseboats, you know, you could hire on these lakes and all sorts of things you could do. And so you didn't. You could always spend a very happy 4 months on leave. I myself did an expedition to Russia, which was rather fun. Three of us, we had a thing called a Willis Knight car, which was rather amusing. And we took a Persian interpreter. And we went to Kabul, and we stayed there with the British minister, as he used to be in those days. There was no ambassador, who did us very well. And then off we set. And we had a most awfully interesting trip. We went through a valley of the Bamiyan, where they have standing Buddhas, which are 90 foot high. They're standing ones, which are very rare, and the monks sort of live in holes going up, you know. I was very amused the other day to see a television program on this subject. They're saying that the only white people who'd ever seen it, because we saw it 30 years before. But we reached the Russian border. We lived off trout we caught in the mountain streams. One of the troubles was, of course, going up these mountains, you had to let the tires out all the way up, because they'd burst otherwise, and then pump them up all the way down again. So we had to get the right pressures, otherwise they'd blow up for the lack of air. It was quite an amusing trip. We really enjoyed it. But that was just one of the things that officers did in those days. We did an expedition, or we went skiing, or anything, go to Bali or Australia. Or plenty to do, and not very expensive, really.
Were you ever... did you ever get out into the Indian countryside at all? Village land?
No. There wasn't really very much to see. I mean, all the villages were the same. They all had lots of flies. They smelt like hell, the beggars, and the odd farmer. But there was nothing really to see. No, we didn't.
Which stations did you prefer?
Oh, I liked Llandicoatl. I was a bachelor. If I'd been married, I think it would have been different. But I was very happy up there. And it was a lovely life and great comradeship, you know, when you're stuck in a place like that. And we had lots of fun up there.
Was one encouraged to learn an Indian language?
Never. I mean, the only words we knew was to call for a large whiskey or something like that, or quo hai, which calls a servant, you know. They're about the two words we ever learnt, I think. Always respectful. They were very respectful, always, to you. And you were the same to them. Yeah. That was always a rule. We respected each other very much, particularly our bearer, who became very attached to you, and you became very attached to him. You know.
You didn't have to be especially firm with one particular
thing. Well, we weren't with the Mohammedans. They were so frankly well behaved. I mean, I never experienced any trouble of stealing or... Of course, they read your letters, but they all do. They do in England, as far as I know. But I mean, apart from that, I mean, they're terribly honest and clean and nice people.
Did you visit any mosques or
temples? No. I never had anything to do. I don't know anything about it today, actually, really. Not really, no. The person we knew was the chap who, the caterer. Well, we didn't have a naffy, you see, we had a caterer. Very valuable. His name was Shamsuddin. And to keep him in office, he had to lavish fairly large gifts to the colonel and people. Because it's a very lucrative thing, this canteen, because it provided everything for the troops, dances and... all the food and the wine and everything they wanted, whiskey and so on like that. So this was the only chap we met because he used to give us invitations for shooting or something of that sort, you know, to keep us sweet.
Did you ever meet any Indian families at all?
Never. No. Funny thing is, you see, we lived our own lives with segregation. I don't know why, because I'd have loved to have done, really, but in those days, we didn't think about it.
Did you regret leaving?
Well, my exit, of course, as I say, was in a hospital ship. So, I thought I was coming back. I never did, of course, because by the time I'd recovered after 9 months in England, war was almost upon us, and I'd rejoined. By that time, my regiment went to Malta. So I rejoined them there.
Why did you join the army?
Well, in those days, my father was an admiral. And he said, four sons. And he said to all of us, well, you can either go in the Navy, or second best, rather a loud voice, the army. Well, of course, my boy, there is the diplomatic service. See, there were only things open to us. There was nothing like... he'd been horrified if I'd run a shop or been a banker or something. So, of course, naturally, he wanted us all to go in the Navy. Well, my eldest brother tried for the Navy, and he didn't qualify. But it was very hard in those days to get in the Navy. I mean, they used to take 40 boys, and there'd be about 150 taking the exam. But he was taken to Winchester, which was quite a hard school, without taking examination, so he couldn't have been all that bad. My second brother got in, all right. And then I turned up. Of course, I'm a complete buffoon. Of course, I hadn't got a chance. So, of course, second best, I had to go to public school, and then I went in the army, which was not so hard to get into. And my half-brother, of course, was colourblind, so he couldn't go in the Navy, so he went in the army. But, you see, we were a service family. We have been for years and generations back. That's my reason. I didn't have any option.
Could you choose which particular regiment?
Oh, yes. If you could get into it. You see, my eldest brother was in my regiment, and I wanted to, being in Dorset, I wanted to go into the regiment. And when you're at Sandhurst, the colonel of the regiment comes down. This is not the colonel of the battalion, this is the colonel of the regiment. He comes down, and he interviews you to see whether you're suitable. That's the first point. And the second point is how much private income have you got? Now, this is very important, because the pay was so bad. I mean, I was paid 7 and 6 pence a day as a junior subaltern. Well, you can't go very far, even in those days, on 7 and 6 pence. So, of course, you had to have a private income, which was absolutely essential. Every regiment, very terribly. The guards, they wanted a lot of money, 1,000 a year in those days, to join the guards. The infantry regiments were much cheaper, depended on the regiment, but they were much cheaper to get to. And I couldn't possibly afford to go in the guards.
But you prefer to go in the Dorset?
Well, I liked it because it's my county regiment. I lived in Dorset. And my brother and all my friends were in the Dorset. That's why I went in. It's a line regiment.
You wouldn't have, say, chosen the guards if all options...
Well, I don't know. If I had, I might have gone the Irish Guards, which my uncle wanted me to do, if I'd had the money, but of course I couldn't afford it. It's no good going in and then finding you can't pay your mess bill. Life is misery.
And what were the reactions of your family when you knew you were going to India?
I don't think there were many reactions. I have had a stepmother. My mother died when I was 5, so that didn't come into it. My father was abroad a lot because, being an admiral, I mean, he was always something, you know, in one of these fleets they have in China or somewhere like that. So I didn't see much of my father when I was a boy. He was always abroad. No, I don't think they worried at all.
And was there any particular training you got at Sandhurst or after you left Sandhurst in England that you found useful?
Not very well. The training at Sandhurst, of course, was a general training, which it still is today, really. I was teaching at Sandhurst some time ago. Nowadays, of course, a boy goes to Sandhurst and he does his general training, and then he goes to a school, whichever branch he's going into. I mean, school of infantry, or he's going to the tanks. He goes to a special school and he gets taught specialised artillery. In those days, the artillery went to a place called the Shop at Woolwich, and signals went there. The cavalry infantry and Indian Army went to Sandhurst. So we were given a general training, and then we went to our regiment, where we went under a sergeant. And the sergeant taught us to shoot, and there is drill. And the RSM, of course, taught us to drill, and all that sort of thing. Though we had a lot of drill at Sandhurst, of course, in those days.
And how long was the period?
Well, I think that the junior officers were put under the RSM for about 6 months before they were given a junior posting in a platoon.